How are we?
How you doing?
Good, you?
I'm doing great.
Doing great?
Yep.
Good.
Yeah.
It's good.
So you want to get your... What?
What's that? So how's the new job going?
Oh, it's going great.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's fun. It's busy. My day goes by super fast.
Oh, yeah.
I look forward to going to work, actually. Yeah.
Well, that's good for a change.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely challenging.
Right.
But, I mean, it's fun, too. Like, I'm really using my brain all day long.
Yeah. And then when you get home, you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not draining. It's more energizing than anything, I guess. I don't know. I feel like I'm doing something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what keeps you... That's the way you are. You gotta... For you, something boring would just be... Just killer on you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So?
So?
Are we podcasting here? Is that what we're doing?
I don't know. Is that what we're doing?
That's what we're doing.
Oh, okay. So what's your theme?
Well, I kind of wanted to talk... Like, I wanted to talk about guitar playing. Actually.
Okay.
So, just to kind of give you a bit of background, a few weeks ago, probably a month, maybe more than that ago.
Right.
Are you familiar with Vinnie Vincent at all, guitar player?
Yeah, from Kiss.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So he. So just to give you some background history, and probably good for the listeners too, to understand, is Vinnie Vincent was brought in. For the Creatures of the Night album that Kiss was writing. And they just came off their biggest disappointment ever, which was The Elder, which was their worst-selling album of all time, still to this day.
Okay.
And it was a concept album, and it was supposed to be the movie... It was supposed to be the album to launch a movie... They spent a lot of money on the album. They brought this big shot producer in, and it failed. Like, completely tanked. And in fact, people were just making fun of Kiss after that.
Oh, lovely.
So the follow-up album to this, they really wanted to have a good album, and they wanted to go back to being... because it was like... The Elder was like orchestral.
Right.
So they really... They reached out to a whole bunch of different songwriters... to get the next album, like, to make it meaner and tougher and more New York, I guess, more gritty, more hard rock, I guess.
Right.
So they brought, one of the songwriters they brought in was Vinnie Vincent. So he was just a songwriter, I think in New York, or I can't remember, Queens or something, and, you know, he'd written a couple of songs for a couple of people, I think, at that point. That it had some success, and he was brought in as a songwriter, and that was at the same time that Ace was quitting.
Right.
So
now is this guy more of the neo classical type of music that he plays?
He's a shredder for sure. Like, he's not from the Ace Frehley school of guitar playing, that's for sure. More he does have a classical, I don't know if he's got a classical background, but he did play a lot of classical.
Actually, you know what? Back in the 80s, I had applied for, and this was a money order, and in the guitar magazine, it was the Rock Method or something or other, and it was from REH Productions.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what would happen is it would come in a plastic case, and you'd have spots for cassettes. So it would have, like, six cassettes or whatever it was, and it would give you some sheet music. And he actually would teach you. And this was before the dawn of YouTube and
oh, yeah. This is the only way to get that back then.
VHS, you know, that type of stuff. So this was just not audio. So this was, it was kind of a step ahead for teaching, I guess, other than just tab by yourself. You could actually have, you know, the tape, and he would tell you and explain to you how, you know, how it goes. So it was pretty interesting. Anyway, I kind of sidetracked a little bit, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, did Vinnie Vincent do one of those?
I believe it was Vinnie Vincent.
Yeah, I'm assuming he would have. He, like, he was in Guitar Player magazine and you know all those different magazines that you know multiple times.
Right.
So he was brought like he wasn't brought into the band as a guitar player really. He was brought in as a songwriter, and they were auditioning all these guys for guitar. I think they even had Rick Derringer, I think, was even, you know, helping them out with guitars and stuff, because Ace was just wasn't showing up. He had quit, and they kind of think they begged him to stay. So Vinny's like, look, I know you brought me in as a songwriter, but I'm, like, a really good guitar player. Like, just use me. I've already written on, I think he co-wrote 4 of the tracks on Creatures of the Night.
Right.
You know, it's just use me, like, you know. So
right.
I don't know, you know, whose decision it was, but, you know, he eventually did replace Ace, and he did play a lot of guitar in Creatures of the Night, as well as co-writing 4 of the better songs on the album, including, like, I Love It Loud and some of the other stronger tracks.
Now, who was actually credited on the album?
I think it was Ace really credited on the album. But Ace admits he didn't. He played on no tracks on that album. But he was featured on the cover artwork. He was even featured in the video they did for I Love It Loud. And he was right. Just basically kind of like, you know,
lip-syncing to Vinny stuff.
Yeah, basically. And it's interesting on the guitar solo for I Love It Loud in the video, it's actually Paul playing the solo.
Oh.
Even though you can tell it's definitely a Vinnie Vincent solo.
Right.
But anyway, so Vinnie Vincent went hiding or went missing kind of for like 25 years. And he just came out at a Kiss convention just like about a month ago or whatever it was. And so I kind of. As a guest, yeah.
Okay.
So now I liked Vinnie Vincent. See, I like Vinnie Vincent. I thought he was an amazing songwriter, but I really didn't like his tone, because he did 2 albums on his own as well. But his tone was really thin sounding. And I think I was listening on the 2 albums that Vinnie played on, which is Creatures and Lick It Up. So in Lick It Up, he co-wrote 8 of the 10 songs on the album. So Lick It Up, its success, you know, in my opinion, was if they hadn't had Vinny in the band, I don't know if they would have succeeded like they needed to. Mm-hmm. Like, the best songs on the album, I think the 2 crappiest songs on the album are the ones he didn't co-write.
Oh.
And there's a couple of crappy songs on there, but there's like some of the best 80s Kiss songs are on that album. Like, really, really good. That album's like super strong. Hmm. So anyway, so he was booted out of the band for creative differences. So there was lots of lawsuits back and forth, and they just canned his ass after a while. They didn't want to deal with him. He just kept saying, look, I want to get paid my royalties, my songwriting royalties. But like I said, he didn't get credit for songwriting on, I don't even know if he got credit for songwriting on Creatures, or he kind of did. But he got shafted on songwriting credits and royalties and all those sorts of things. I think Kiss was collecting the royalties and just not paying them. And they were paying him like $500 a month or something, or $1,000 a month to be in Kiss. And he wasn't getting any royalties.
Really?
Something like that. It was like he couldn't afford his apartment, and he had a wife and kid.
Right.
A wife and kids, I think. Or he was married anyway. He couldn't support his household. And he wasn't making enough money. He's like, well, can you just pay me my royalties? Like, you know, I co-wrote, you know, 8 of the songs on there. So right. I should be getting, you know, 50% or 40% or 25, you know, at least 25%. Whatever
it was. The writers were the ones who made all the money.
They do, but the thing
that he had a bad lawyer.
Well, like, there's a lot of examples where everyone gets songwriting credit on an album to keep the band happy, even though one person may have written all the songs for this band, for example.
Right.
You know, like Warrant, Janie Lane wrote all the songs. So say Janie Lane, he's going to get 100% of the royalties and the band gets paid nothing. So a lot of times what the manager will do is split the royalties up to keep the band happy. Or they may give, or they might do something like give 50% to the songwriter and then spread out the rest of the 50% amongst the rest of the band members. Like, they'll do some sort of split just to keep the band members happy, because even though someone writes the songs, everyone helps, you know, arrange it and orchestrate it and that sort of thing. So anyway, he got shafted a lot, and Kiss do what Kiss want to do, and I don't know who's the right or wrong in the lawsuit, but he came out and I watched, you know, all the footage from the convention and stuff, and then I'm like, yeah, he was a good songwriter, but I don't think I gave him a fair shake back in those days, because he was a shredder and he was kind of glammed out, and I'm like, oh, I don't really, you know, I liked it because he was a Kiss guy, but just the production, the way it was recorded, was really, this had this really, I don't know, like an air raid siren sound to the guitar that you couldn't always make out what he was playing.
Okay.
Like, I like clarity in my guitar players. Like, I like to hear what they're playing. And sometimes it just, I don't know, tonally, maybe because he was... What's that?
Is that what you mean?
Huh?
It gets kind of all muddled in the background.
Yeah, exactly. So, anyway, but I went back and I'm like, you know what? Like, his guitar tone on those Kiss albums versus his solo stuff, it sounds like he's playing through a completely different amp, a completely different guitar. You know, you can hear what he's playing, and it's his lead playing on the Kiss albums were very melodic, but very technical at the same time. Like, they were really, really, really good.
Right.
And they kept telling him to slow down, you know, less distortion, less whammy, you know, less this, less that. So
yeah, make it sound more like Kiss.
Yeah, well, exactly. They wanted him to sound like Ace Frehley, and like he's no, they're two completely different schools of playing.
Right.
You know, one guy's the Stones, and one guy is like, you know, Tchaikovsky or some shit like that. You know.
Right.
But I guess what I wanted to ask you, like, during that, the 80s heyday, there was all, like, all the guitar magazines were, you know, their sales were going through the roof. Everyone wanted a hotshot guitarist in their band, like Whitesnake, you know, they poached Steve Vai. And they paid, and they brought him in the band, and they gave him $1 million a year, I think, while he was in the band. And the members of the band weren't even getting paid like that. You know, it was a marketing decision to bring him in and relegate their lead guitar player to rhythm.
Who is this? Which one?
Whitesnake.
Whitesnake, okay.
Yeah, so they relegated their lead guy.
Billy Campbell?
No, it was they had Adrian Vandenberg.
Okay.
Yeah, Vivian was out of the band at that point.
Okay.
So Adrian Vandenberg was like the main guitar player and the main co-writer with David Coverdale. So, you know, basically what I was saying, like, even Whitesnake, you know, they pushed their lead guitar player down to get a flash and balls guitarist like Steve Vai to help sell records, because it was the trend at the time. And I guess Kiss did the same thing with Vinnie Vincent, like, they bring a hotshot guitarist in.
Right.
And then they did it again, like, two more times. They kept just bringing hotshot guitarists in. And Alice Cooper was always doing that, poaching, you know, these shredders and stuff. So right. I guess, what's your opinion on the whole shred scene of the 80s with the guitar, the lead guitar player getting all
okay.
the
Here's the basic thing. Here's the basic picture. Okay, back in the 80s, as soon as the glam hit, it was just wow, right? It just hit like gangbusters. I mean, you've seen documentaries on all these bands in California, all these hair bands, you know, and the whole thing just exploded, right? Anybody that could sing in a really, really high register, you know, whether it was any band, I mean, Europe, you know, AC/DC, Journey, like anybody who could hit those higher register notes. And Poison, and I could just name them on and on. Like, in any hair metal band back in the 80s, like, the singer always had a high register, pretty much.
Oh, God, yeah.
any way you can think of.
Yep.
There may be a couple of exceptions, but... Okay, so when you're young and impressionable, right, when you see this, you know, and you see these, and they get the big hair, and they get, you know, the women everywhere because they're trying to sell it, right?
Yep.
And they get the music and the lights and, you know, just the whole lifestyle. And what they do is they glam it and then they publicize it to death.
Yeah.
Okay, and that, and when you're young, that is your world, right?
Yeah.
And that's what you see. And the weird thing is when you get older and you look back and you watch these documentaries, you go, you know what? These are people just like you and I. I mean, it's all the background stuff that they're doing that just throws people right to the screen. You know, it's not their personality. It's more of a persona.
And with
the flash guitars, I mean, that was the thing. It was like as soon as Hot for Teacher came out, or Panama, or Jump, or, you know, any the Van Halen stuff. As soon as that started coming out, in my mind, that's when the whole scene kind of started to hit. Because I mean, it went from Eddie with his guitars. You know, the Strats are usually all single coils, right? So
yeah.
Then he pulled the single out of the, you know, out of the Gibson and threw it in the bridge position of the Strat, and, you know, voila, there's your, you know, type of thing. And then there, all the manufacturers started to go in that direction, and then the Marshalls and the heavy music and the hair and just the whole scene. When you're growing up and you're seeing like that, you're just, your eyes are just huge, and your mouth is hanging open going, wow, like, to be part of that, you know, you looked up to that.
Oh yeah.
So any of these flash guitars that come out, like Steve Vai and Satriani and Eddie, and, you know, all these guys, when they played, they were just so unique at the time when they came out, and they did it so well. And it's just the tonality of the amps and the way they captured it. I mean, they just captured your heart in a way. Like they would just envelop you, and you'd be like, yeah, that's what I want to be, you know, and you look up to that, and that's what you try and strive for. Of course, you know, when you're young and you hear these songs and you really want to play them, and you go out, and yeah, like the guitar magazines, guitar player magazines, I mean, they had, back in the day when people started turntables, they had those little plastic insert sleeve things.
Yeah,
you pulled it out, and you could play it on your record player.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, nowadays I think they throw in a CD or a DVD or something like that.
Yeah.
I haven't bought any for so long, but and back then, I mean, all the covers were just covered with all these hairband guitar shredders, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, they're giving them, okay, well, here, you know, we want you to, I mean, Eddie, I don't think I ever heard of Kramer before, you know, they showed up and went, okay, we want you to play our guitars, you know, type thing. Where when he started, when he's at a place where he's just kind of piecing together parts, you know, to put together something that's going to work.
Yeah.
And I mean, same with the one that played with Ozzy.
Randy Rhoads?
No.
Or Jake Ely?
Jake Ely, sorry. I think he was the same. He was in the same situation. He didn't have any money. He just kind of put this thing together. And then, you know, they came up, you know, later on and said, you know, what if Sydney guitar will make, you know, which is nowhere near the same quality as it was that they started with. So, I mean, what they started with is pretty much just, you know, they try and sell these guitars like, here, you'll be able to play like this person if you buy this guitar.
Yeah.
Which is a bunch of horse crap, right? Because it's all marketing. I mean, you can go into wherever and pick up, you know, it doesn't matter what it is. I mean, you can shred on it. I've seen videos on YouTube where they're playing, you know, these really heavy, heavy songs on these little Sears or whatever, these little toys, and they're hilarious.
Yeah.
And the thing is that they can make it sound like that, and all you need to do is put a little bit of production in the background, and that's all you need.
Yeah.
You don't need all these big amps and fancy guitars and whatnot. I mean, it's more, you want to buy something that's, you know, that you can play. It's not like a tree trunk with something you got to, you know,
force. So are you saying, like, this is all, like, all this 80s proliferation of, like, all these guitar players and stuff was really just marketing tools, and it became popular because it sold guitars and people wanted to sound like these people, so really it was just marketing to sell, you know, particular brands and all the brands were fighting over each other and then endorsing, like, even the worst guitarists of all, I think, were getting endorsement. Like, everyone was getting endorsement deals back then.
Well, I know they were signing on bands, like, left, right, and center once they figured out what it was that sold. And they wanted to get these singers that had these really, you know, Sebastian Bach and that.
Oh, yeah.
And getting these guys out there and sing. But I truly, honestly think the 80s was the guitar shredder's time.
Yep.
You know, if you were, like, prior to the 80s hitting, when all this kind of blew out and you were in the scene and you were growing into it, if you were fortunate enough to get signed or be good enough, you know, to be signed or be lucky enough to be in a band, you know, I mean, I think a lot of it is right place at the right time for some people.
Yep.
And then some other people, you know, could have been management. It all depends on, because everyone's different, right? Everybody approaches it in a different way. And the ones who market it to death pretty much, you know, rule the roost. But I still have stacks of guitar magazines or somewhere.
Yeah.
And you see every once in a while someone in Kijiji have a whole bunch for sale.
Yeah.
But you still can't get, like, even if you look up Tab Online, it'll give you someone's transcription of it, but not necessarily the correct one. So, I mean, I kind of like that aspect of it, of having it on hand, just in case I ever run into something that I wanted to learn, so.
I think it was interesting, though, like, it was kind of a thing that, oh my god, like, these guitar players are hot now, and then every band, I found that, like, the record labels and the bands themselves are, like, I don't know, either, you know, they may have had a band, you know, with a couple of good guitar players, but they'll get rid of one guy and try to bring in a hot shot young kid who, A, looks good, B, can shred, might not be able to play in time, or may never be able to play the same solo twice. You know, like, that sort of thing. Like, Kiss, back on the Kiss train here, Kiss brought in a guitar player for the Animalize album, Mark St. John. And he was brought in because, hey, you know what, we got rid of Vinnie Vincent because they had issues with him because he actually wanted to get paid. But they then, you know, like, well, we need a shredder in because it's the 80s, man. If we're going to stay relevant as a band, we can't have our meat and potatoes Ace Frehley type playing. We need a shredder. So they brought this guy in, and the guy was a good shredder, but he wasn't a good musician in terms of he could never play the same thing twice. Like, he could solo and he could improvise, but he could never, you know, learn a particular solo and play it again, ever.
Hmm.
So they had a hard time with that guy. Like, they had a really hard time. And I think, just from, you know, my layman's perspective, I think there was a lot of guitar players that could shred and play really fast, but they weren't necessarily good musicians. They just, you know, they could just play fast. But it's like a drummer that can play fast. He may never be able to play a swing, you know, a swing beat. But he can play really fast, but he can never play in time. Like, do you find, like, that, was that the case with the guitar players?
I mean, all the guitar players that were hotshots were all, like, 18 in and around that area.
Yeah.
So I mean, the maturity level of a lot of them was probably not there musically. So, I mean, you can only, I mean, you can improvise and be a great improviser because I play by ear mostly. So for me, it's always improvisation. I'm always changing things up until I find something that clicks. And then once it clicks, I usually stick with it.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of play around with stuff, but I mean, it depends on the individual.
What do you mean in terms of playing or in terms of tone? Like, what are you referring to? That you'll
say when we're writing something and, you know, I'll listen to something that we had played, you know, last year, and then I'll watch us play it, like, say, this year.
Yeah.
And I'll go, oh, I changed something in the song. Because I was actually watching our videos from the beginning and just to see how things were kind of changing and progressing. So, and I noticed that a couple of the songs have changed a few things in the way I play it.
Yep.
Which I like better now because it kind of fills it in better.
Yeah.
But as to, say, playing it different every time that I played it, no, you got to have some, you know, what do you call it, stabilizing anchor of a song. You can't.
Yeah, you can't change it every time.
Yeah, I'm going to start putting a bunch of slap stuff in there, just, you know.
Well, I like it when you play slap on that bass.
To funk it up. But
I think, like, the same, like what you're saying, too, but the singers, like, all these singers had this high pitch, and then all the guitar players were these young wunderkinds that, you know, they could play really fast. But I think there was, I think what they failed to see, like, with the, you know, the emergence, I think you're right in saying Van Halen, the emergence of Van Halen was, okay, well, you got the guitar player who looks really freaking cool, and looked, he always, Eddie always looked really young, and, you know, and he's, you know, and then you get David Lee Roth, like, the fritz out hair and, you know, the crazy spandex and shit like that. All the hair bands that came after that were emulating Van Halen, really. And, you know,
pretty much. But I mean, the Doors are like all the bands back then all had long hair.
Yeah.
They just, I don't think they were teased and poofy as
they weren't
back in that era. But
so like I think they were just trying to find the next Van Halen. Like even Bullet Boys, for example, which is one of my fave bands. Like Ted Templeman, after he stopped working with Van Halen, he's like, okay, well, I need to find a new Van Halen. So they went and found Bullet Boys. Okay, well, the guitar player looks strangely like Eddie, and mm-hmm. the singer looks strangely like Dave.
Oh, really?
And the bass player is a better looking version of Michael Anthony, I guess. But they, you know, they wanted the Eddie Dave combo, right? Is what I think they're looking for. And in fact, the singer even, you know, did some of those same. You know, Dave used to do some of those screams or whatever, like kind of the same screams. The only difference was the guitar player, although he was good, he wasn't Eddie Van Halen, that's for sure. But the singer was a far better singer than David Lee. So, but I mean, they look the same. It's like, okay, well, let's try to, you know, I don't know. It, like I like originality. I do.
Yeah, it's kind of like when you're talking to your cousin Danny, and you talk about now they just kind of spit out music. It's all algorithms. I mean, what works and what doesn't. All these BPMs and, you know, with this mood and, you know, all the psychology evolved and all that stuff. It's kind of the same, but the mentality back then of how they would do it.
Yeah.
So they would say, well, what works? Well, this works.
Well, this guy has blonde hair. This guy has brown hair.
Yeah, you know, I think people do that, you know, across the whole broad spectrum, whether it's, you know, that or hockey or whatever. Like, everybody had a way of doing things, and then they kept trying to outdo, and then eventually everything kind of progressed to the point where, okay, now everybody's doing this.
Yeah.
You know, to get the end result, which is a shame, because now you've taken the whole, you know, thing of music, and you've just kind of made a big mosh pit of the same stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after this whole gamut of hotshot guitar players, mm-hmm. Something happened to the music industry, and, you know, the hotshot guitar players were kind of falling out of fashion.
I think it's when Nirvana started.
Yeah, well, I think
the grunge movement.
I think it kind of started a little bit, just a little bit before that, but I think it was I think Nirvana basically drove it home. But I think what was happening, it became a parody of itself, and you'd have all these guys playing as fast as they could, but they actually weren't really any good. It's just like, oh, I'm just going to play as fast as I can, and then the singers were, you know, their hair kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think it just self-destructed. And I really think the music industry set about its own self-destruction by, you know, just oversaturating. Like, no offense, but, you know, Poison doesn't have a shredder for guitar player. And then all of a sudden he kind of had to be a shredder to fit in.
Well, I mean, that's what they do for a living. I'm sure they kind of progress in their playing. It just kind of depends on where they're at and or if they did want to progress or not. But I believe that once the 80s were over. I think the stock in makeup and hairspray and all that stuff dropped significantly, and all our shareholders for Revlon and all these places were probably just having a shit, you know, fit over it.
Yeah.
But yeah, as soon as the music changed, the look obviously changed. It went from, you know, spandex, big hair to just, you know, just grubbies, just jeans, ripped jeans, and just mop head, and you know, it wasn't anything. I think they were shooting more for music instead of the look.
Yes, the music was actually mattering again.
Yeah, and they kind of. It kind of switched the type of music, but I think it went okay for a while, and then it just kind of dropped off because, I mean, if you listen to now, it's like you're listening to, I mean, people want to play guitar like Taylor Swift. Like it's changed so much in the way that music has gone, I find, because I mean, you're getting all these bands from way back then. I mean, even Black Sabbath, I mean, they had the reunion. I know they're trying to bring stuff back, and then these other bands that, you know, you would have never thought, figure, you know what, everyone else is doing it, and yeah, why don't we? Because I mean, I don't know what the royalties, I'm assuming that they don't get the same amount of royalties when they were hits. So I'm assuming they're going to be, you know, if they didn't invest properly or whatnot, they'd probably be looking for more work.
But it's funny, like, because they get paid a lot, like, signing bonus, you know, we'll give you $1 million up front if you guys, you know, reform.
Or but you got to remember that, I mean, unless you're actually, you know, current, then, I mean, the money's just not going to be there. I mean, it'll be there at the beginning, and then when things wear off or genres change or just, you know.
I think, like, Zeppelin was offered, like, $100 million to reform or something. Something ridiculous like that.
Get together, yeah. Well, I mean, once the drummer passed, I mean, that was it. And I remember hearing them saying in interviews, like, you know, if something ever happens to one of us, like, that's it. Like,
yeah.
We're not performing anymore because it won't be Led Zeppelin. It'll be, you know, just kind of a shoot off of that with an extra person. Where, I mean, other bands, I mean, some of them, you know, switch players, you know, as often as they change their socks. So,
yeah.
It just kind of all depends. And some people, they just use studio musicians for whatever they're doing. So, and those guys, I mean, they're excellent at their craft, and they actually went to school for it, and they're very, very good, but they don't get the recognition that all these, you know, everybody that's in the spotlight anyway.
There was a little band, and so the transitioning to the grunge era and all that, there was one little band that came up as hair metal, for lack of a better word, was dying.
Yeah.
In 1987, I don't know if you remember who it was. Who do you think?
Is it a well-known one?
Yep.
Like Firehouse or
no, Guns N' Roses.
Wicked. What's that one with it's like a clown on the front.
Oh, Dangerous Toys.
Dangerous Toys, yeah. There's a whole bunch. I mean, these are bands that you introduced me to only because you were getting rid of your old cassette tapes.
But these were, like, actually, like, bands like that were good. They actually had good musicianship. They kind of got lumped into the whole hair metal thing, but they weren't really. They were just rock bands. They weren't. Somehow they just got lumped in that, and it's like, well, you have to have, you know, you have to have your Eddie, like Iron Maiden had, or you had to have. I don't know. They had to fit within the convention, and they guess they kind of did. But those bands all died out. Like, all those good bands like that all died out. Like, you know, a band like Dangerous Toys were really, really solid. Like, they were, to me, they were never a hair band. And, you know, a band like Tesla, for example, like, they weren't about being pretty boys at all. Like, those were kind of, you know, not good-looking dudes.
True, Yeah, and I like Tesla. They're excellent.
But solid musicians, like, there was, it's funny, like some of them were able to ride the coattails of the flashy looking bands that may not have been that talented, but the talented musician bands actually kind of rode on their coattails in order to get signed. It kind of was backwards, I guess, in the end. But then in 1987, like before the whole grunge thing happened, 1987, Guns N' Roses put an album out, and they weren't glam, but their first video, their hair was teased up to the moon.
Because back then that was the thing.
Like that's what you had to do, yeah.
Other image consultants or whatever they use, I'm sure, as time goes on. If you look at bands back in the 80s that are still relevant today, you can tell that they've obviously changed their look.
Oh, yeah.
To reflect the times, because obviously, I mean, you can't... There's not that many bands out today that... I mean, the ones that have been around for ages, like any metal band that's around for ages, yeah, they still have their coifs,
yeah.
Their big hair, and I'm sure they dye it, because I'm sure they're not jet black if you really look at the roots, but then again, it's all image.
Yeah. What's interesting now, I was just finished watching a documentary called, what's it called? It's on Netflix. It was called Hired Gun. Yeah, I think it's called Hired Gun. And there's a movement now, or there's been a movement for the last little while, for pop stars to bring in a guitar player. Now, not to say that pop stars don't have guitar players, because a lot of pop stars don't really have... Well, Michael Jackson, I guess, was one of the first ones to do it. And
he did the Beat It one, yeah.
Yeah, well, with Beat It, yeah. And then Janet Jackson did the same thing. She got this crazy killer player on guitar, but now it's a really trendy thing. I suggest you watch a documentary, but they're talking like this. So Mandy Moore, for example, brought in a guy, and she wanted, like, they wanted a metal looking dude with tattoos and black hair and, you know, a metal player. She wanted a metal player.
Now, is this for a visual thing on their tour?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, it was considered cool. All the young girls, you know, were kind of like, you know, like, oh, you know, kind of learning about, oh, the, you know, there's an instrument called a guitar, and it can sound like this, and the guys that play guitar generally look this way. It was kind of it was definitely image related, but, like, Mandy Moore was very picky, or her management, or whoever, was very picky and really wanted an accomplished guitar guy, and there was this guy who'd been around and done session work and could never kind of get his own band landed, and he got an opportunity to play for Mandy Moore.
Right.
And, you know, and they really wanted him to look metal all the time. Like, they didn't make him look all poppy. They wanted a metal-looking guitarist, and they'd allow him a little time to shred on stage and stuff like that. But there's a few bands that have done that. Pink did the same thing. Like, it's kind of like a trendy thing now.
Yeah.
Again, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about the money and the sales. That's the only thing that ever drives any of this. And if someone, you know, if the clientele is out there, they'll push it till, you know, till it gets what they want, pretty much.
And then they just change the gears, like Mandy Moore, get rid of this guy. It's the guy that plays for Five Finger Death Punch, I think.
He's a guitar
player, but this is where he was playing. And I think it's Five Finger Death Punch. Anyway, it's one of those types of new metal bands. But anyway, it's funny. Like, we need a guy. We need a really good, strong guy. Let's, you know, who can we find? Oh, this, you know, we hear about this guy. They bring him in. He looks the right part, and he can play guitar too. But I think it was more image. And then the minute that, okay, you know what? We're going to change gears with Mandy. We're going to do, we're going to try different kind of music. You know, we really don't want to have that type of person in our band. Like, they, you know, actually categorize this person as that type of person. And then they just get rid of them just like that. Just like, oh, it was a cool thing for 5 minutes. But why wouldn't they just keep the guy in the band?
It was a one-trick pony just to...
Well, yeah, but, I mean, the guy's a really good guitar player. Like, I wasn't totally aware of who this guy was, but watching him in his documentary, like, this guy can shred.
Right.
But he could play anything. So it's like, why would you get rid of him? Like, because he doesn't look right? Like, that just... That's what gets me about pop music nowadays. It's, you know, they're really not interested in the songs. They're not.
Well, it depends if it's, like, was it a concept album they were doing and they just wanted to have, like, it's like a shredding thing?
No, or? I think they had a, they, I don't know if it was for a track. They, you know, they wanted a, you know, basically a Beat It, you know, where they have a searing guitar solo in it. And they kept him around and he just played guitar, like, he was their guitar player. But, you know... It's funny, it's like, back in the day, you know, if we go to a show, you know, we go to a show and we're wearing a black t-shirts and our jeans, and then someone shows up wearing, you know, powder blue pants and a pink shirt or something, that, you know, like that's...
It was out of place.
Yeah, and it was, I don't know how...
But I mean, they're not just doing that with guitars, too. I mean, Santana does that with singers, like the Snake Pit. I mean, everyone seems to be having special guests on their albums.
Yep.
Which seems to help to diversify and also have the fan base of the person that they're having there also listening to, you know, the other bands also. So, I mean, it's kind of a cross thing, too, they're trying. I'm sure it's... their friends and whatnot also, and they're saying, hey, you know, you should get together and do something one time, and someone does it, and then they go, oh, they were really successful, why don't we try that, you know, and all these other bands kind of, and it's pretty much a mob mentality when something works. So it's like when they did with the singers in the 80s, I mean, with those really high voices and stuff, like they flooded the market to the point where it couldn't support them all, and then a bunch of them fell off and only the strong ones survived type thing.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
I like how, like, one guy who, Alice Cooper, like, he's always got, like, a hotshot guitarist. And unlike, you know, the Mandy Moore situation or, you know, any of those types of bands that, you know, have a guy on, like, he, like, the people leave Alice Cooper's band. He doesn't get rid of people. People leave his band. But what he does is he really, you know, he's still a huge name. He goes on tour. He's got a hotshot guitarist. He's very good to showcase, you know, his musicians. It's very important for him to showcase his musicians. And then these musicians get notoriety because they're playing with Alice Cooper. And then maybe they can make a go at it at their own band. And he gives them their blessings, like, you know, hey, Alice, you know, we got to, you know, I'm going to quit. I really want to push my band now. And he's like, hey, by all means. You know, he really pushes them and endorses them, and, you know, like, it's like, that's the right way to do it. Like, I don't, the pop stars that are using musicians are using, you know, great guitar players. They're not doing it the right way. It's, I don't know. It's kind of unprofessional, I guess.
Well, it's kind of hard to do it live when you have all these other bands. I mean, unless you're doing when the Eagles did the tour and they had all the different players from all the different eras. They would come up and play with them. I mean, unless you have a band where you've got, okay, we're touring, you played on one of the songs, now it's like, well, now we're just going to get one generic guitarist who can do all of it. and not the, you know, the actual person. It would be kind of hard to do if you were to try and reenact it. But if you're just doing an album and then people listen to it, then, I mean, that's quite all right. But
yeah.
Live will be a little different.
Yeah, in that documentary, like, Pink seems to be doing it the right way. She seems to be treating her musicians with a lot of respect, and she's had, like, the same people for a while. So it's kind of interesting. But
I'll have to watch that for sure. You mentioned it before, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it's called, I think it's called Hired Guns.
Hired Guns?
It's really good, but they also talk about, like, and it's not just guitar players. It's basically session guys that never really have their own band. So it's got, like, the drummer from John Cougar Mellencamp.
Right.
Like, that guy's a monster.
Yeah, bands like that, you never heard who the musicians were. It was always the main, you know, John Cougar. Yeah, okay, he's here. Brian Adams, yeah. But you never hear about the people that they play with, really.
No, it, I mean, it's kind of...
Unless they're well known, like, say, Tina Turner played with Brian Adams, okay, you know who she is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the drummer, the guitar player, whatever, like, they're all kind of like the, I don't know if those, they may have been just studio musicians that he kind of hired and kind of had on.
Like they had Billy Joel's guys, and like they were with him for a long time. And in fact, one of the things they mentioned is Billy Joel was going to go into studio and record an album, and the studio or the label or whoever it was said, "Oh no, you don't have to bring your guys in. We have our own session guys. We'll just record with them. They know the studio. They know the sound. Blah blah blah." And they're like, "No. Like he's like, "This is my band, and we're doing the album with my band." And he really, you know, stuck to his guns and you know, and made sure his band was on there. And I mean, his band's collaborated with him on the, you know, the how the songs are put together and everything. Like Billy Joel was a songwriter, but you know, he wasn't the only guy that put the songs together. Like his drummer had a lot of say, and his bass player had a lot of say, and his guitar player had a lot of say. And then at one point, you know, I don't know what happened, but I guess Billy got swayed, and then, you know, he got rid of most of his band, just like that.
Wow. Was it a show or a movie that you were watching where they had, you know, they really wanted this guy to play music and whatnot, but they went, you know what, your band, we should use our own guys because they're professional. Like, instead of being an organic band, they just kind of like, you know, we'll take the musicians away, we'll just keep the singer, and we'll just use our own guys, just give it the music and the play, I think.
Well, that was a movie? Was that Rockstar with Mark Wahlberg? Maybe or something?
No.
But I mean, that was the story of the Doors right away. Like, they're all trying to sway Jim Morrison away from the band. Oh, you've got the look, you know, you've got the sound. Like, who cares what your band sounds like? You know, we can market the shit out of you.
Right.
Because he's good looking.
Yeah, well, it's about money.
Yeah.
Who can you market? These guys marketable? Yeah.
Yeah.
No. And then,
but I mean, like, who's writing these songs? Like, I don't know. To me, it's like, I've heard of a few bands in the city where, you know, the singer gets offered shit. Like, I'm not going to name any names because I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I've heard this story many times with people in bands here in our city where they're just like, "Hey, you know what? You're awesome. You're great. Let's just take you and we'll bring you into the studio with a bunch of session guys." Like, it just happens all the time. And it's like, well, why? Like, is it just to make it easier for the person recording the album? It's like, well, if the producer's not good enough, you know. But I guess back then, it's the label paying for everything, right? So if you're a band and you're going to the studio to record, you're paying them to record you. And if it takes longer because everyone's not as adept, well, they're just making more money.
Do they have the same, like, I know the Actors Guild or whatever, they've got, like, their own union or whatever, however you call it.
Yeah.
Do musicians have the same thing? Because, I mean, the studio musicians might have something, maybe with the studio saying, well, you know,
I don't think they ever had anything like that. No. Not that I'm aware of. Like, I don't think there's a, you know, musicians union or anything. Because they're always doing, the reason I say that, because they're always doing, you always see these fundraiser concerts to help out, you know, Joe Blue, you know, who's a session player in Memphis, and now he's sick, and now he has no money, and he's got to go to the hospital, and he can't afford to pay for anything. So I don't think there's anything like that. They just, you know, it's feast or famine. They're either they get paid really well while they're working, but
there is no security at all.
Yeah, there's no security.
In music, there is no security.
I'm almost home here, so I would say I would recommend you watch that one. Mm-hmm. It's really good. It's really entertaining, and I think your beloved would enjoy it too. I think it's a very interesting look in the music industry. But then there's also two other ones. There's called Muscle Shoals, which is worth watching, and that's about Muscle Shoals.
Okay.
So strongly recommend that one. That's about the famous recording studio where famous artists went in, and they always had the same, you know, session musicians that recorded.
Great.
And then there's another one called The Wrecking Crew. Now, the Wrecking Crew is probably the better of the three, but the Wrecking Crew are the ones that recorded. They were the band. They were the Beach Boys band. The Beach Boys. They rarely recorded their own music in the studio. Like the musicians that played live, it was on the albums. It wasn't. It was all the Wrecking Crew people.
Oh.
So it's the same band that recorded. That recorded, and the musicians that recorded did a whole bunch of Beach Boys albums. They recorded for like Nancy Sinatra. It was like These Boots Were Made for Walking. I think Percy Sledge, Marvin Gaye, like all those. Like apparently there was a point where most, if not all, of the songs in like the top 50 charts or whatever. It was all the same musicians on every, like on most of those songs, or 80% of those songs, or 90%, or whatever it was. It was all the same musicians. It was all different artists. It was like, oh, Percy Sledge, and it was Sam Cooke, and you know, and this guy, and that guy, and you know, and this band, and that band. Like, they were always using the same session guys, and they're all recording at that one studio. But those, you know, musicians never really get credit, but they were paid really well.
So just kind of a lump.
What's that?
Depending on who the artist was, they would get paid accordingly, I guess.
Well, they get paid for their session work, and they get paid. I don't think they made royalties. I don't think they were paid that way.
No.
Because they're not officially songwriters; they're just brought in to do a job, right? But it, from what, when you watch these documentaries, you'll see that, well, they actually kind of wrote the music. Like, maybe there was a light arrangement that came in, but they wrote the music. Like, they were the session musicians for, I think, for Paul Simon, or maybe Simon and Garfunkel, too. And just, like, it's ridiculous if you see the resume of these musicians. These musicians should be talked about in all the music magazines more than anyone else. You know, they shouldn't always be about Led Zeppelin or Guns N' Roses or, you know, Van Halen. It should be these people, because they could play any style of music. They've had more number one hits than anyone.
Right.
You just didn't know it was them.
Exactly.
So it's I don't know. Check out the Wrecking Crew one. That's the really good one.
Okay. That was on Netflix?
They're all on Netflix. Okay, if you watch one, all the other ones will probably pop up too.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, anyway, very, very interesting.
Cool.
I don't know. It kind of made me go like, God, you know, maybe I would want to be a session musician, you know? Like, it sounds like hard work, but you get paid a lot for each, you know, each gig. But you never have that going to go play live, you know, it's just studio stuff. But
yeah, and there's nothing It's nothing that's regular either, that, you know, it's guaranteed, so...
No, it's like all of a sudden, you know, Aretha Franklin's in town and she wants to record a song and she wants to record it tomorrow. Are you available? Right. Well, you can't really say no.
Not exactly.
You just gotta show up and go play.
Pretty much good. Yeah, just wait for the phone to ring.
Say, and then there'll be something like, okay, well, we need a killer bass line at the beginning of this song. I need you to record it this afternoon. So, you know, they'd have to just come up with something, like, if they did, they got the job, and if they didn't, well, you know, too bad. Too bad, so sad.
Well, they know who they work with and who's good at doing what, so, I mean, they would say, oh, this would be good for such and such, and give them a call, and have them come in and lay down the tracks, and away they go.
Yeah, pretty cool. All right, well, I've made it to my destination, so I'm going to piece these two together and we'll put this up, and I guess we'll see you on the flip side.
All right, sounds good.
All right.
All right, see ya.